Boss Lady. What are you doing now that you're at the top? I'm Andrea Gigline.
And I'm Christy Atwater. And this is our podcast about women leaders doing more than making a bigger paycheck.
That's right. And we've got a great guest today, a woman who started on the path of a big career in business and ended up in a very different place.
But let's talk about Downton Abbey first.
Really? What do you mean?
You know, that PBS show, I love that show, about lords and ladies in an era long gone when everyone dressed in lovely outfits for dinner and had ladies' maids.
Absolutely. My daughter-in-law was a devotee to the max and she got us into it.
Me too. Then you know all about the daughter who threw it all away and married the chauffeur.
Hey, she knew better, you know.
Our guest can relate. Let's find out how Liz Ortenberger is CEO of SafeNest, a Nevada nonprofit devoted to ending domestic violence. Liz, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Liz, we are so glad that you can join us. We want to talk about that little Downton Abbey connection. We didn't want to tease our audience that way and not. But let's talk about that in a moment and talk about your history, the experiences that you've had. It's an unprecedented time in our world. How's the pandemic affecting your world?
Right. So as a domestic violence agency, and we serve victims, batterers, and children affected by the epidemic, we are at a perfect storm for domestic violence to be incredibly high. Clark County, Nevada is incredibly high for domestic violence on a regular day. So then you layer this on top of it. And it makes sense, right? When we understand the backstory of domestic violence, the added stress from a recession causes an increase in domestic violence. Mm-hmm. Check that box. The added stress from a natural disaster or even our October 1 shooting, that Correct. Layer of stress causes mm-hmm. an increase in domestic violence. Check that box. Then we ask everybody to stay at home together, mm-hmm. and we've created really a toxic cocktail for domestic violence to be on the rise.
Now, knowing that, for you, what's it been like?
You know, I am so incredibly proud of SafeNest as an agency. The 3 years before COVID, we really spent putting a lot of energy into having a major financial turnaround for the nonprofit. It needed to build its reserves. It needed to be stronger. It needed to have depth in its staff and in its hierarchy. Every same concept you would hear in the for-profit world to run a good business, you need in the nonprofit world. We're just not paying stockholders, right? Or where there's not earnings that go out in the same way. But you have to function with a business mindset. And we'd spent the 3 years prior to this doing that. The result of that is that we are sitting on it's not as large as we would like, but a reserve. Great. So we were able to, instead of immediately say, oh, funding's going to be down, this is going to be catastrophic for our books, we were able to say, how do we leverage our resources to the maximum? Because we know the community and victims of domestic violence are going to need us the most right now. And we have really, I joke that we ran into the fire, hopefully with our masks on, because we increased our shelter capacity by over 100 beds by utilizing apartments and hotels throughout town. We increased our hotline capacity, and we went 24/7 with our Metro Response Program, which is the perfect example of what communities are crying out for. How mm-hmm. can police work better mm-hmm. with agencies Correct. Like ours? We are the poster child for that program, and we took it to 24/7 during the pandemic. So has it been stressful? Absolutely. What I've noticed as a female navigating these waters with two children, a second grader and a fifth grader, is the added layer of the school piece mm-hmm. has the tendency to be the tipping point in my day where I will find tears. Because it is a nightmare to manage because the school district came at it from a standpoint of every child will have a parent and they'll be at home. Well, that's right. not, I can't have my children at home. I take calls about gunshot wounds and things that are happening to people in the domestic violence world. And my job is not predictable, right? I can't Correct. Say, let me take that Metro call in 30 minutes. So my children are distance learning and trying to connect the dots between the distance learning at the YMCA, which is doing an amazing job, and their teachers and not have my children left behind.
Sure.
And then, you know, we translate that to the children that are in our care at the shelter, not having them be left behind. That added layer has really added the ingredients that have made it much more stressful. If the kid piece was taken care of, this would be manageable, as is my job on a regular basis, because my job is chaotic.
Don't you think that's the motto for the United States?
Yeah.
If the kid piece is taken care of,
yes.
Can you imagine what we could achieve collectively?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, it doesn't matter if it's a pandemic. It doesn't matter what happens.
Yep.
If we had the safety systems in place for that one demographic,
yes.
Imagine what we could
accomplish. That's such a great point, because the generational data that we look at in domestic violence, 76% of children that are growing up in households where domestic violence is present will repeat the cycle as victim or as batterer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If we could intervene with those 76%, which SafeNest has a program, it's certainly not reaching 76% of those kids. If we could intervene with that 76%, we could wipe out domestic violence in 3 generations,
right.
Probably 2 generations.
Wow.
But that takes a long-term view and an investment by society in a completely different way than we view it now. You know, the way we fund schools, the way we do all of that is it's punitive to children that are growing up in low-income situations. And there is absolutely a correlation between low-income communities and domestic violence. We don't talk about it in the movement of domestic violence because it's not popular, but the stats are clear.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So there is absolute magic in getting the children piece taken care of, and how can we do that?
I have to agree with that, because in this pandemic, my husband actually happened to resign from his position on March 15th.
Mm.
So it was perfect timing, and he was able to care for our son and actually homeschool our son. So that has been off the table for us.
Yeah.
And I think we've had a much lighter load than the rest of America because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know he's taken care of, and it's an added stress that we don't have.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been some benefits to us in this pandemic, in that, you know, less social obligations and so forth, where I feel like, wow, my life has slowed down and I've been able to read a book or, you know. So it is a totally different experience. And I do feel sorry for those parents, because it could be a total, you know.
Yeah. And I think I like to think my staff are lucky, because they have a female CEO who's in that space, and
right.
I get it. And so creating systems where it's totally fine to use our copy machines for kid copies.
Right.
It's totally fine to need a half an hour to have a conference. We're funding the cost of distance learning up to 50% of the cost that a family's incurring. Because even families that have now one parent who is unemployed,
right.
they're looking for work.
Right.
And you
right.
can't be homeschooling right. when you're trying to find a job. So it's really complicated. And there is absolutely, you can see so clearly this group of women sort of who are building their career, who have young children, that are going to be the ones who get left behind in this, and they'll mm-hmm. be behind in earnings, their entire career. So as the CEO of SafeNest, I really wanted to make sure that wasn't the reality for my staff.
Correct.
But I'm an outlier. I talk
exactly.
to my nonprofit peers, and that is not happening across the board. And
right.
it saddens me. In the for-profit world, I think Sands Casino's trying to do the right things. I think the Wynn's trying to do the right things. People are trying.
Yes.
But the fact is, there's just a complete lack of resources for businesses to have it make sense.
And you did bring out such a beautiful point, and it's actually the point of why we do this podcast. What is different when women lead? The way you view the needs of the organization don't just start with a P&L.
Right.
Yes. It really expands. Forget that your organization is a community, a necessary community function. It is a huge organization taking care of a lot of people, including, you have a lot of employees, correct?
We do. We have 81 employees, and we service over 20,000, 30,000 victims a year.
That is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one thing I want to ask you about, because I'm really curious, with, you know, law enforcement has been taking a lot of criticism this year,
yep.
and you all are partners with them.
Yes.
How have you helped support them during this time? Because as we all know, I think, and believe, that mm-hmm. not all law enforcement is bad.
Right. Yep.
And actually mostly good.
Exactly. Individuals may
be a problem, bad apples, but
it's not the system.
You know, it's interesting. I regularly sort of get angst from other domestic violence agencies about my willingness to work not only with Metro and other police agencies, but also with the courts and in all the places that, you know, we've sort of as a movement somewhere along the line wrote them off as bad. And what I, one of the things that we were sort of able to take a really pragmatic look at is the policies that govern police behavior, aside from the bad apples.
Correct.
I, that I understand. Everybody has a profession that, you know, they have, you have folks who you need to let go. But the police policies around the way that they deal with things is really what's at the heart. When we talk about systematic racism, what are the policies that are governing that you, that person gets put down on the ground and handcuffed behind their back and that one doesn't, right? So there's a lot to unpack for the police. What I love about our relationship with Metro is it allows me to speak publicly about a fantastic agency that has long worked on community policing. What Sheriff Lombardo has done with community policing and seeing his force, the Metro force, as partners in the community cannot be understated.
Correct.
And so when people push back on us, which happens, we're able to speak to that. You want to talk about defund the police. How about we talk about where that partnership can be best elevated? And so it gives me an opportunity to educate when I start to get pushback. I'll tell you the other thing that I'm really proud with Metro, and this I just got this story this morning. We have a client in shelter right now. It was 2 weeks ago. We responded to the scene as we do, and the client needed to come into shelter. The Metro officer called the client just a day ago, yesterday, and asked how she was doing. This is how Metro functions.
That's exactly right.
We know that they get 70,000 domestic violence calls a year.
Yep.
These calls matter. That's a, that's the overwhelming majority of their calls, and the officers care.
Yes.
And it matters to them. And that's that is a cultural piece of Metro that I think as a city we can be incredibly proud of, that we sit under that police force if that's your district. I'll tell you the other thing, Metro was incredibly supportive of my team that goes out into the field. So the partnership, I mean, they're like buddies, right? They meet on the scene and they talk about what's happening, and then we provide confidential services right there while they keep it safe for us. This is how partnership works. And I was so frustrated in the beginning when the Minneapolis City Council voted to defund the police, and one of the city council members was on, I don't know what network, talking about, well, domestic violence advocates could just go in there alone, right? They could handle it. Domestic violence is the most dangerous, most lethal call police go on. There is absolutely no way I would ever send my advocates to a scene of a domestic violence 911 call without Metro or any police force's support. So there's a need to educate the population about domestic violence. There's a huge need to advertise this partnership, and we will do that. Right before COVID hit, the State Department actually called and asked us to do a much more widespread approach to sharing the program, which we're very, very happy to do. But I'll also say, you know, we live in a very unique community.
We do.
The reason this program was able to go 24/7 during the pandemic is because we got a $500,000 grant from Nevada Women's Philanthropy.
Yes.
And Nevada Women's Philanthropy was a $500,000 grant this year. That's a group of women who get together and give $5,000 a year each. They get a vote. Nonprofits go through a rigorous process.
And my Congresswoman, Susie Lee, was actually one of the founders of that.
That's right. And Susie's an amazing, another amazing tribute. That kind of magnitude.
That was like 20 years ago they found. 2020?
Yeah, I think
it's
so.
It's been a long time.
And they started out small and they've grown. This was the largest grant they've ever given out. But that's the uniqueness and the specialness of Vegas. I've fundraised in Boston, LA, Tacoma, Seattle. It is not like that there. There's a community here that when leveraged can do incredible things, and we're seeing that. So it's, pandemic is horrible, and but it's bringing out some great things in our community.
You know, and one of the things that I want to bring out for hope for others.
Yes.
We weren't as a state always like that. We weren't as a community always like that. I think as soon, you know, not in the so distant future, in like the late 70s, we had some really odd laws, as many places do, where, you know, If the wound or the bruise wasn't big enough, it really didn't qualify as domestic violence.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't just here. That was nationwide.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. But what I would like our listeners to really get, progress is possible even in something. You know, we've touched on so many social issues that have come to the top of the percolating list in this country through this year. And your organization faces them one after another. And then the combination of needing the cooperation with the police in order for you to be able to help the people that you do. And it is possible.
It is. And that's the, you know, for any of my nonprofit peers who are listening to the podcast, the thing that has made SafeNest successful, which by every marker we are successful. Mm-hmm. Do we have work to do? Sure. So does everybody.
Sure.
But the thing that has made us successful is it's collaboration.
Yes.
And we, you know, we sit now with a group of my peers on a hidden violence coalition talking about sex trafficking, domestic violence, and sexual assault, because these are the assaults on the communities, mostly women, that we don't talk about.
Correct.
So that brings us together and says, how can we make sure we're not duplicating? How can we make sure that we're set up as a community to be best for the victims? That's where power lies.
You know, Christy, that's one of the things I think you bring from corporations that we keep hearing when we interview our corporate clients. Collaboration is one of those additional characteristics that women are more given toward.
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen over and over again with all the women that we've interviewed in this podcast is that really aligning or getting allies in men. We want people to know that, you know, hey, boss lady isn't just about women in leadership.
Yeah.
It's also the men that helped them get there and the men that supported them. But now I want to pivot a little bit and get back to the fun that we started off with.
Wait, we need a breath.
We need a little break.
we need a breath.
And then we'll go heavy a little bit. But let's talk about Downton Abbey and the connection there. Did you run away from a grand castle?
I did not run away from a grand castle. But as you see in that series, it's the end of wealth in British aristocracy, sort of that between World War I and World War II period. And that is my family's legacy, right? So my parents were the last generation of wealth, right? And we refer to them now sort of pejoratively as a society as trust fund babies.
Right.
But both my parents were born into wealth, raised in boarding schools, and lived similar, not quite on the level of Downton Abbey, of course, but my grandparents and their parents, that was their trajectory. Mm-hmm. So I'm very thankful that I'm in this generation on the other side of that, because for my parents, it was incredibly difficult to British families. I don't think American families are much different. You don't talk about money, right? You definitely don't talk about generations of wealth running out.
Correct.
So it's not like my parents sort of knew that their life was going to be incredibly different than the circumstances in which they grew up. But, you know, I sometimes go to these nonprofit conferences and things, and they'll say, who is here is the first in your family to go to college? And I'll raise my hand. I'm raising my hand for a very different reason. My parents never thought they needed to. College wasn't really a thing for that, for their group of people, right? So it is a very interesting thing. It's taken me now much into adulthood to really reflect on it and understand it. But there's a lot of scars there from parents trying to understand how to raise kids when they were not raised by parents, right? They were raised by nannies in boarding schools. And, you know, first world problems, right? I mean, put it all into perspective. I've never gone hungry. I've never had any of those issues that poverty, the kids growing up in poverty are faced with and do incredible things. But my trajectory is sort of, it is what it is, right? You don't get to write that. You're
Correct.
Born into it.
Right.
So it's been an interesting thing to sort of look back on. And somewhat, I mean, neither of my parents, who I have a relationship with anymore and haven't since I was about 19 years old, because they were so unsuited to be parents. And I could so see the toxicity. And last generations of wealth leads itself to alcoholism, drug abuse, other controlling behaviors, because your entire environment that you thought you knew and controlled is gone. Right. So like our house, I grew up in the Napa Valley in Santa Elena on a small farm. My dad was a hydroponic gardener.
Okay.
And that all got bankrupt. I went away to summer camp, which was one of my favorite things to do. YMCA Camp Raven Cliff, mm-hmm. went away and came back, and we didn't have a house anymore.
Wow.
And that, talk about dysfunction, right? Nobody yes. prepared me for the fact that
no one mentioned that.
No one. So we were living with grandma. My parents thought it was best to get a divorce. That probably was the best. But there was, you know, but you don't process these things. I say British families. It's probably families in turmoil.
Yes, I was going to say, you're explaining something that when people don't have a passion for, when they are, we always think that, if I had money, everything's going to be okay. No. We have many generations where that's not the case. Yeah. Money is a lovely thing as long as you have interest and you have your values and strengths that you can keep putting forward in a community, in a work that helps you build forward. And it sounded as though your parents was part of a generation where, no need to be educated because you'll have money.
Yeah.
And no need to find a meaning in life because you'll have money. Oops, that didn't work.
Yeah, and for my mom, I can only imagine that it was more stressful than it was for my dad because, she's expected to marry rich, right? I mean, that's how it works, right? You marry, there's the whole thing there. And my dad turned out to be in the same predicament she was, but neither one of them talked about it.
Wow.
So when I joke that they didn't talk about the foreclosure on the farm or the family house, but I don't think my mom knew it was happening. I don't know that my dad knew that it was happening.
No wonder you're helping women take control of their lives.
You just please look at your bank accounts, right?
Yes.
And there was always talk of these secret funds all over the place. I was about 14 when all this was going on. And so as a 14-year-old, you're sort of immersed in everything that's going on with you anyway.
Correct.
So it was a chaotic time, but it's led me to a path I couldn't be happier. You know, I love where I am in life. I'm fortunate to have two small children who are, they're not that small anymore. They're 10 and 7. But it led me here, and I feel so incredibly fortunate. You know, people say things happen for a reason. I think it's really, we're blessed when we can see reason in the things that have happened to us.
Fabulous.
Right? Because it's hard to make sense of anyone's baby dying, right? That doesn't happen for reason.
No.
That's a horrible thing. But in my circumstance, it's just been like, okay, well, this has led me here. And I want to lead a life of passion and value. I have an older sister and a younger brother. I know now more about why I'm sort of where I am. My older sister is not. She is, she's in a very dark place and has been since we were in our 20s. She's a year and a half older than me. And I have a brother who's incarcerated for felony drug trafficking and gang activity. So I definitely sort of, I was buffered because I'm the middle child.
Correct.
But also was instilled with a level of hope that my future was going to be okay from the trajectories that I took differently than they were. And
you know, and I don't want to just skim over that. The ability to hold certain characteristics.
Yeah.
Your ability to see in the worst of situations in your own personal life that something can be transformed from it. The ability to hold that I have hope when other members of my family did not have that one characteristic, and that's a difference. The cool thing about all of that is that at any given point, they never lose the option of and the potential of it happening also.
Yep.
And you being the example of this is how you put one foot in front of the other, because I think that's what's so important when we have conversations about, you know, what are you doing now that you've made it?
Yeah.
It isn't about just making it. It is all those steps you took long before you got to sit in front of mics and really impact people's lives by your story and through the actions that you've taken.
Yeah.
Now, I just want to ask the question about how did you end up as the CEO of Safeness?
So, it's a long and winding road, right? Like most of my life, it's taken a trajectory. So I was with Girl Scouts from early in my career. That's really where I built my career the first 8 years. I started at a Girl Scout Council in Santa Barbara, California, and worked my way up from a part-time weekend event coordinator to the chief operating officer, and then recognized sort of my passion in nonprofits along with the mission is the business side of it. So I went to business school, had the misfortune of graduating in May 2008 with seven. I had seven job offers, which all dried up in like a week and a half.
Oh, no.
So what do you do, right? So we came back to California, which is where we had been living before. And I just started applying for jobs. And fortunately, I have, you know, in the nonprofit world, you build a brand like you do in the for-profit world. Mm-hmm. And I have a reputation as a turnaround. I am somebody who can come in and do a financial turnaround. Mm-hmm. So I take a lot of pride in that because I love it and it's important. So the YMCA hired me to be the executive director of their camping arm, the Los Angeles YMCA. Loved it, did a huge financial turnaround on their camps, which I take a lot of pride in because they serve a lot of low-income kids. It was amazing to see kids come out of like Compton never having seen stars because they it does not get dark in Compton for a reason.
Right.
And they come to camp and then they're arguing with me about where eggs come from, right? And I've got like chickens right there and they're arguing with me. It's just those things fill my life, right?
Yes.
These little vignettes. So I was there for about 3 years, then went up to Tacoma, Washington to work for the Y up there. Girl Scouts here called me in Las Vegas and asked me to come and be their CEO. I said, well, fantastic. I'm ready, feel ready to move out of that executive director role into that CEO role. And so moved the whole family here. And that was a little tougher. We did a financial turnaround, but what I learned from that experience is the culture of your board of directors really matters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you have to be the right CEO for that
board
group, right? Mm-hmm. And if they're looking for something that doesn't feed your passion, you either need to have a very candid conversation about change or one of you's got to go. You don't want to live in disharmony. That's a stressful place to be. So I left Girl Scouts and really took 4 months off, which worked out okay because I did consulting projects. But my husband at the time had same husband I talked about earlier, who's now my ex-husband. That's when he really decided that our marriage was over. Which was a surprise to me. So I took 4 months to kind of regroup. I spent a ton of time with my kids, which was amazing, and consulted. And somewhere in that period of time, a friend of mine called and said, hey, are you interested in Safeness? And I, like many people, was like, what the?
What's Safeness?
And then I was like, oh, it's domestic violence. Well, what is domestic violence, right? Because you don't walk around identifying these things. So then I went through their interview process. I did take a class on domestic violence before I started their interview process because I wasn't sure. You know, my whole world has been youth development, which is long term, right? We're in it for the long game.
Yes. Right.
Domestic violence is right here, right now, victim services. And I wanted to make sure that I could have an impact that the agency deserved. And I, when I listened to the class that I enrolled in, I just fell in love with it. And luckily interviewed and they hired me. And the rest is sort of somewhat history. It's been almost 4 years and it's gone by like a blink of an eye. We were laughing in the office the other day when my HR manager's like, I've been here 3 years. I'm like, no, you haven't.
Yeah.
Yes, he has.
Yeah.
But so that's how I ended up there. And, you know, we talked about hope a little bit. That's what's connected me with the work. That was my biggest fear about coming into domestic violence was I don't want to be in a place where we can't actually go downstream and say, how do we fix this thing?
Mm-hmm.
And hope's a big part of that. And really the scientific definition of hope plays a huge role in the work that we do. But that's how I ended up there. But that's what's fed my passion. And there is, with 81 staff and the size of operation we run, there is a lot of business things that feed my mind on a regular basis. So
what has surprised you most about being there,
you know,
that you didn't know?
The lack of sophistication in the domestic violence movement is a bit appalling, right?
Oh.
There, you know, we are, this is again, sort of really fortunately Vegas. We're the largest agency by far. So we have kind of this privilege because we're that size that we collect a ton of data because we deal with a ton of clients, right? So we can start to trend analysis, predictive analytics around the work that we do, which will lead to us focusing resources in a better way. when I go to domestic violence conferences, this is not the conversation I'm having with people. It's not high-level, analytical, data-driven. It is small. I don't want to say small-minded in a negative way, but I literally went to a domestic violence conference where the entire conference theme was keep domestic violence grassroots. And I said to people there, if breast cancer would have stayed grassroots, where would we be? If AIDS would have stayed grassroots, where would we be? Why are we doing this to the victims, primarily women, who are in our care thinking that we need to be small to somehow be impactful? And then we don't share a collaborative voice, right?
Right.
We argue with each other in this movement in a way that Girl Scouts has its ups and downs.
Yes.
But at the end of the day,
yes,
we're aligned about empowering
young
girls.
Women.
Right.
But domestic violence is so fragmented.
Yeah.
So that's really
been a big
surprise.
I was unaware of that.
It's incredibly frustrating because I do see such an opportunity. You know, here's one normal question any CEO in any industry would ask. Show me where the best practices are, and then what's the ROI on the investment, right?
Yep.
Those are normal
yep.
questions any
sure.
of us would walk into any business and ask. I walk into a domestic violence shelter in another that's not mine, they are going to look at me like I'm speaking a different language because they're not engaged in a way that's actually going to change,
correct.
Right? They're only dealing, I think I used this metaphor when we did the Zoom one. If we think of this in terms of cancer,
mm-hmm.
all the majority of the domestic violence movement and really society for that point is doing is making a victim comfortable from the symptoms of cancer.
Right.
They're doing nothing to eradicate the tumor mm-hmm. or understand why the tumor got there to begin with. And the fact that we work with batterers and victims is incredibly helpful for our agency. But any domestic violence agency that is out there saying we're here to end domestic violence, if you're not working with batterers, you're not ending domestic violence.
Right,
right.
All you're doing is supporting the victims, which is absolutely worthwhile.
Yes,
but
you have to
be
do that
clear,
too. Yep.
That's not ending the epidemic.
You know, I have to say that I really can align with what you're saying because I have followed certain philanthropic organizations, and one of them is Bloomberg Philanthropies, mm-hmm. because I was always intrigued that as mayor, he had 10 million people, and then he had all this money that he would then fund the programs that he could see work, and he's very numbers-driven. And I've recently come across another one, Catherine Murdoch's organization, UniteAmerica.org. Their pages actually say, we look at the data.
Mm-hmm.
That's what helps us bring right. out the solutions.
Right.
And it aligns very clearly
yeah.
with what you're saying. You know, we've taken a ton of your time, and I just want to ask one more question.
Sure.
So for young women going forward,
yeah.
what's your greatest hope? Where do you see it all happening?
You know, it is an interesting time to be a woman entering the workforce, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pandemic aside, it's an interesting time to be a woman entering the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
I think here's what I would say. Find, you know, we always say find your passion. I think that's fair. But to me, it's think about where you really want to be in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a mom with two kids? And then what do you see your career looking like? Do you want your career to be weekends and evenings? Really think about what it is that you want from a lifestyle perspective. I think for a long time, we've hammered the find your passion, build your career, work, 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 work,
mm-hmm.
work. I don't think that's sustainable.
No.
I can do what I do day in and day out because I have balance. And I've
Correct.
Managed most of my career to have good balance. That will feed your passion,
yep.
both inside and outside your workplace. So think about what that looks like for you. And if you're driven by working hard and doing those things, and you will find the other pieces will connect. But think about the balance. I think it's, and I, you know, I say this, and this is my circumstance. So if it's not yours, you know, take mm-hmm. the advice.
Sure.
It is okay to wait having kids.
Yeah.
I had my children when I was 34 and 37.
Mm.
mm-hmm. healthy, beautiful babies. I had no indications yes. from a medical perspective that I needed to have children younger than that. The nice thing about having your kids when you're more established in your career is just that. You're more established in your career. So for me to take 6 weeks off as an executive director or CEO is much different than a junior accounting rep.
Correct.
Taking the six yeah. weeks off. And like it or not, the workforce is still dominated by male ideals. Even in my workforce, and we work really hard at this, HR is still a male-driven because the business is male driven. So
right.
there is realities to taking maternity leave and all of those kinds of things that are going to continue to have an effect on your career. It all gets easier when you're older.
Correct.
And so, I totally agree.
Yeah,
I had my son when I was 43.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
And you know, I think my experience has been totally different.
Yeah.
I don't have the mom guilt that other people have
yeah.
and I still have a very large career.
Yeah.
Yep. And, again, a different experience for me.
Yep.
You know, Liz, the amount of things in your story, the diversity of your story, just hearing the respect for the police, just knowing that we can do this better and there are better ways and there are women like you who, in fact, are getting it and collaborating with others to see us go forward. I mean, for me, that means a lot. So I want to thank you for joining us today. And I want to thank our audience for listening in. As always, I'm Andrea Gigline.
And I'm Christy Atwater. And you're listening to Hey Boss Lady.